Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And I'm Daryl Etherington.
This week, we are going to be reviewing Foundation, the science fiction series on Apple TV Plus that just wrapped up its first season. Before that, I just thought we could maybe talk about a few other things we're watching that we may or may not end up doing full reviews on, but probably won't. This is mostly just an excuse for me to say I watched all 8 hours of The Beatles Get Back on Disney Plus, and I think it's great, and everyone should watch it, but I'm not going to try to force Jordan and Daryl to do it, so I'm just going to mention it.
I don't even know what that is.
I like The Beatles, but I'm not interested in this at all.
It is basically there's like all this unused footage of the Beatles recording one of their last albums that was turned into a movie 50 years ago. And Peter Jackson, the director of Lord of the Rings, basically spent the last 4 years going through all the footage, restoring the footage. And I think originally he planned to release it as a theatrical film. But because he now it seems like it's impossible for him to do anything without turning it into a trilogy of overlong movies. Yes. It is a series where every episode is between 2.5 and 3 hours long. So it's three episodes. Each episode is 2.5 to 3 hours long. That's just like a lot of footage of the Beatles recording their last album. And then it sort of climaxes with them staging this rooftop concert, which was their first public performance in like 3 years, and also their last public performance before they broke up. And I think there was a lot of interest in it from a specific kind of music or Beatle fan, because this is a period that is considered to be like a very acrimonious period where that was essentially the beginning of the breakup. And in fact, like the footage shows that it was... They definitely were like fighting and feuding a lot, but there was also a lot of like just creative collaboration, and there's still like a lot of tenderness between them. And so if you're invested in the idea that John and Paul were really friends, it's like affirming to that point of view. I think the other thing for me, I'm only a pretty casual Beatles fan, and so it doesn't matter to me whether or not like John and Paul were fighting at this point, is it just seems like the most detailed portrait of like musical collaboration that I've ever seen, where you actually see a bunch of absolutely world-class musicians and songwriters in the studio writing songs that will eventually become famous. Like you see Paul in the studio noodling around with Let It Be, and then George comes over and is like, hey, you know, maybe it would be better if you did this. Or you just see John and Paul kind of riffing with each other, and like suddenly like it's like this noodle that was nothing suddenly becomes, you know, the song Get Back. Yeah, I thought it was pretty amazing. It is too long. Like the ideal version of this movie is probably 5 or 6 hours, not 8 hours, but I also thought it was
wow. 5 or 6 hours.
Five
still?
Or six.
Like casual Beatles fan. Liking the Beatles is so boring and basic. It's like liking pizza or puppies or something.
Sure, that's right. I mean, that's what I mean.
You don't like pizza or puppies, Jordan?
I do. I admit my basicness, and I have a Beatles shirt, and of course, everybody likes the Beatles. It's just like, would I dedicate 8.5 hours of my life
right.
to learning
more? I don't
about
consider
them?
It a personality no. trait that yeah. I like Beatles.
Yeah, and that feels like once you get into the 8.5 hour mark, that becomes kind of personality traitish, right? Like that's right. too much to give to something that basic. I wouldn't spend 8.5 hours understanding pizza. I just like eat it because it's a nice thing to eat, although I do spend quite a bit of time on my puppy, to be fair. Right. Yeah, so this is kind of on topic. I read Daisy Jones and the Six recently. You guys,
what's that?
No idea.
So they're turning it into a show, I think, like Hulu or someone is, so it'll find its way into our orbit soon, I'm sure. But it's a book that's set in like the 60s about this fictional rock and roll band, the Six, And then Daisy Jones is also a songwriter, and then they collaborate, and that like takes both of them to like superstardom, top of the charts, everything. And it's about, you know, the interdynamics of like recording an album and some of the stuff you're just talking about, like, oh, you know, like what if you did this and what if we did this, but also the dynamics of a band itself with like a lead singer, and then the lead guitarist was his brother, and he was married, but then Daisy was kind of a temptation for him, and he was sober and Daisy was an addict, and they were like, it's pretty interesting. But I do think that that whole environment, like real or fictionalized, of creating something and like what it takes to do that, right? Like to create art and how it bonds people and breaks people, and the connection that's formed when two people can kind of like riff off one another and make something bigger than either of them individually is really special. But yeah, I have no interest in watching Get Back. All that to say, I have no interest in watching this.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's part of why I'm bringing it up now, is because I just don't want to expend my friend capital on trying to convince you guys to watch it. So yeah, I would say that just if you are interested in that creative process, I think this is, I can't think of anything that sort of matches this in terms of just giving insight into how that works. But if the idea of watching 8 hours of the Beatles is of no interest to you, then I think you already know that you don't want to watch this.
Yeah. Also, what is the, like, at what point is it not, Peter Jackson could, like, I feel like it's not, you're not a director anymore. You're just like a person who put a bunch of video together in Final Cut or something. Like, you just put it unedited together, and then we're like, here, it's all of it. Idiots, enjoy, look at it all. And then it's like, oh, hi, Paul, did you ever think about doing this one? And then Paul's like, oh, no, I didn't, George.
Oh, my God.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl. The show, great, wow, amazing, creative process. It's like the Taylor Swift documentary, remember that? That was like 1 hour or something, or one it's and a half hours. It was horrible. It was painful to watch. Wow. I would rather not see the process that these people go through to create the thing. I'd rather have nice thing on the end.
The Taylor Swift thing.
I thought that was good. I also think in general, and this is not an argument at all, just purely a statement of taste, I would 100% rather watch 8 hours of a behind-the-scenes music documentary than a true crime documentary.
Oh, yes. 100%. No, you're 100%. Both wrong. Agree, I mean, on this.
It depends on which one, right? But, like, you're
this is
wrong.
True. In
true
general.
True crime is so good.
What's made me happy is that I've heard nary a peep about Tiger King S2. I have nothing. I have no information about it. Maybe people have watched it.
I think we all know that it can't be that good. It's kind of like Making a Murderer. Like, what? Making a Murderer was like took, like, 10 years to put together. And then they were like, oh, and season 2 is out in 18 months. And you're like, you don't have enough, right? Like, this true crime stuff takes decades to get good. So when you try to rush out the sequel, I think we've all learned, like, you don't. If you couldn't figure out who did it in 10 years, you're definitely not going to figure it out in the next 18 months, right? Like, so, and there's that meme on Instagram that's like, Netflix true crime documentaries are like, who did it? And then a bunch of scrambly lines. And then, like, we still don't know.
yeah.
Right. Which is, I mean, that's sort of the template set by Serial, the podcast. And so that's just how it is now, which is.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine.
Jordan, something else you've been watching is Lost in Space, the final season, which I know you were maybe a little worried about. It was going to get a little tangled in your head with Foundation.
Yeah. I don't know that that's possible just because they're on the spectrum of sci-fi, they're literally couldn't be further apart, I feel like.
Oh, interesting.
In tone and content and everything. I mean, Foundation is like clearly, in my mind, Foundation is pretty prestige TV. And Lost in Space is like family fun. So they feel very different. I mean, if you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, you know I'm a big fan of Lost in Space. I think it is like good, clean sci-fi fun. At its best, and I really like, it's a little hokey, but it hits the spot for whatever reason. I'm not all the way through season three, but it's more of the same, essentially, and with a layer of, you can tell we're trying to culminate towards the end of something. Also, the kids are older, particularly Will Robinson, like, whatever, he got his growth spurt, so he's like he's like a little man, he's like all arms and legs. But yeah, I mean, it's fine. I'm always bothered by the actual robot in this.
Oh.
Like, the shape and feel of him, like, to me, you're supposed to, like, love him, and I just can't. Like, his arms are, like, most of the length of his body, and maybe that's very, like, humanist of me to not accept the robot. But, yeah, I don't know. It's fun. It's, like, just a bunch of twists and turns, and like completely, like, you think sci-fi is known for like putting you in the unbelievable situation and then getting you out of it, right? Like, there's always some weird, like, if we just mix these two molecules, then we'll have more air to breathe or whatever, you know, like, it's just right. Like bizarro solutions to bizarro problems. Like, Lost in Space just does not give a fuck. Those writers are literally like, we're gonna have the ship swallowed by an alien and then we'll figure it out later, or like, I mean, it's just completely outrageous. But that's part of what makes it so fun. And they have, like, the most insane plot armor. I think they tried to play with that a little bit in this. And they put someone in actual peril, and you're like, wow, are they really doing this? But then you're like, no, they're not doing this. But, yeah, it's good. I if you're into, like, the softcore sci-fi, like, just fun, then... yeah, it's a great series. I really liked it. I've enjoyed it so far.
Well, when you finish it, we'll see if you want to do a full episode.
We'll see how I feel about the ending.
Yeah, we can do a combined Get Back, Lost in Space episode.
Oh, yuck, no.
I've tried watching Lost in Space. I tried just again recently, and I was like, I don't know, I just can't get into it. But I've tried it on just... the first time around, I got through like most of season one, if not all of season one, but... then I couldn't remember anything about it, so I started watching it again from scratch. But
I think season two is definitely a dip, and it moves so fast. I mean, one episode could be like four episodes of another show. So, like, even when I picked up season three, I know I watched season two probably twice all the way through, and yet when I picked up season three and was watching the recap, I was like, I don't even know who that person is. Like... the episode I'm in right now, there's a whole plot point about some villain, and I like have no memory of him. So yeah, it's one of those things where you either like accept the fact that you don't remember every single detail and just like power on, but I think if you go back and watch it again, you're boring yourself to the point where you don't want to soldier forward. So
yeah, maybe I'll just jump right into season two then, assume they'll recap me enough.
I mean, the basic premise is that they're lost in space. So if you just go in knowing that, then you're pretty good to go.
Well, yeah, let's move on to Foundation, which is based on a series of short stories and novels by Isaac Asimov. So maybe one place to start is, Daryl, I mean, I think you'd read the stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah, all the ones that he wrote himself. None of the ones that were continued.
Right.
Sort of like after the fact or whatever. But yeah.
Did you approach this feeling like, oh, I love these books, they better not fuck it up?
Kind of. I was more like curious. I was more like, I'm so intrigued in how they do it. I didn't really feel like invested in it. Like, if they had messed it up, I just would have like gone like, oh, well, you know, good try. It was bound to be tough, and then moved on with my life. But, you know, I was surprised. Like, what they did was, in some ways, a very faithful adaptation, and in some ways, totally not at all. And yet, it's like, I really like it. I like it separate from the books. I don't really kind of like they're like maybe cousins or something. I don't think like of them in the same way. And then, but I like them both for their own relative merits quite a bit.
Jordan, had you read or known anything about the books or the story beforehand?
They had been recommended to me like by so many people. I think anyone who like knows what I'm into was like, you got to do this. But I never bit the bullet and did it. But I could tell like, I could tell watching the show, it was like, this had to have been a book, right? Like, just how far reaching it is and how, like, detailed it can be and how everything interweaves and takes place over such long periods of time. It just, like, has very, like, it, this might be insulting to Foundation, but, like, Game of Thrones vibes in terms of, like, just how big the cast is, mm-hmm. and how far reaching it is. It's very, like, world building, which a lot of sci-fi is world building, but this is, like, very, very detailed. So it felt, like, very clear. I'm definitely interested in checking out the books. I wonder how I'd feel about it going in the wrong order, which, to be clear, it's always the wrong order to watch and then read.
Right. It's true. Although I think even it's also a thing where even if you don't actually watch it, I feel like if you just, you know who was cast and see commercials or posters or whatever, it already starts to, or if you, even if you just buy a copy of the book with, like, the actor on the cover or whatever, I feel like it already starts to affect the way you read it, because then you just start to see certain actors as certain characters. So I think it's sort of inescapable as soon as, like, it's been adapted, but
that's almost, like, less bothersome. That's the one thing about it that I don't mind, because, like, in a show you're given the character and you're like, this is who this is, right? Like, there's nothing to kind of, and then it might conflict a little bit with the book, but you already have the idea. Whereas when you picture the person in a book and then you go to them on TV and they're not what you wanted, it's actually, like, much more disturbing to me, I think.
Yeah, that's fair. I would say that it was really hard for me to watch this show kind of on its own terms, because the Foundation books were the books that first got me into science fiction. They're definitely still among my favorite books. And so I definitely went into this being like, they better not fuck this up. Even though pretty much any other adaptation, nowadays I just go into it being like, I don't know, I hope it's good. If it's not, you know, the book is still there, so who cares? But this was one where I was like, yes, please, please. I feel like I've been waiting for this my whole life. And I felt that the show, like Daryl said, is really different from the books in ways that are totally understandable. But, well, I think in some ways where you're like, of course you had to do this, and in other ways that I'm less happy with. And so it just took me a long time to just try to turn off the part of my brain that was like, well, that's not what Asimov meant. And just accept the show for the kind of smart, thoughtful, fun science fiction show that it is. But the concept of Foundation, which I think already starts to illustrate why it's a hard story to adapt, but also I think is one of the all-time, like, super cool concepts for a science fiction story, is that it's tens of thousands of years in the future. There is a galactic empire, and this mathematician named Harry Seldon invents a new science called psychohistory, which is basically a combination of, like, politics, psychology, sociology, economics, that allows you to predict the future, or at least the sort of probabilities that different things will happen. It's sort of like 538, the website, taken to, like, the ultimate form. And so he predicts the fall of the Galactic Empire and this period of darkness and chaos for 30,000 years. And at this point, it is too late to stop the fall of the Galactic Empire. And in fact, in the show especially, I think it's implied that actually stopping the fall is not necessarily a good thing, because the Galactic Empire is pretty bad. But to sort of lay the seeds for a new empire, or a new, you know, unified government that will be far better. And so he creates this foundation with the goal of over 1,000 years, bringing this future to pass. So it's this scientist who basically, especially in the story, he just dies very quick. I mean, he's, you know, this isn't a spoiler, because he appears very briefly at the beginning of the first book and then is gone for the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of his plan being put into action over a period of hundreds of years. So there's not, like, a single cast, because every time the next story comes along, usually there's been a jump of, like, 10, 20, 50 years to kind of the next problem. And so there's no ongoing cast you don't really get attached to anyone. It's much more just, here are these sort of broader concepts that I'm going to introduce, these different historical problems. So it's none of that makes you think, oh, this is going to make for a great TV show. It definitely, I think, makes for a better TV show than it would make for a movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it would be.
I don't think you could ever put any of this into a movie. It would be. No. You'd be so confused and you'd not care about anything.
It's kind of like the Dune movie problem, but I guess Dune is more successful with it.
Dune is much closer to the book than Foundation is.
Yeah.
So the way they've essentially approached turning it into a show, and David S. Goyer, who's well known sort of screenwriter who's focused mostly on comic book adaptations until now, he basically, like, the way the show is structured is that there is this initial kind of set of episodes that's focused on Harry setting up the foundation, and then it kind of jumps ahead, and the rest of the season is about dealing with kind of the first crisis that the foundation confronts. So for most of the first season, you really do have one set of characters, one through line, and then, you know, in future seasons, I do think you're going to, well, yeah, I know that you're going to see those big time jumps that you do in the book.
Yeah. But they've set up in this show, which I think is smart, and one of the concessions, like, there's going to be more consistency across those huge time jumps in terms of, you know, characters that you relate to and recognize than is possible or happens in the book, right? So that's kind of, I think, one of the things that it's done, where it was like, well, how do we adapt this in a way that works for television audiences, mm-hmm. that is successful, and that also, I think, makes sense in the way they've established the fiction. So I'm actually quite impressed by that. And I wasn't sure. Initially, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. But then by the end of it, and I think it's like you said, Anthony, like, I was like, just let go of parts of the book that you were hoping to see mirrored, like, identically, and then you're fine with it.
I think my favorite thing, actually, in the adaptation is something that's essentially completely new, which is the concept of the genetic dynasty.
Right, and yeah.
Essentially, that there is the Emperor of the Galactic Empire they're all clones of one man, Cleon the First, and all of them since then have been Cleons of various numbers. And there are always three of them. Brother Don, who's usually a child or an adolescent. Brother Day, who is, 40-ish. He's played by Lee Pace. And is kind of the one who is who has the most power, and is, if you're going to pick sort of one ruler, he's the ruler. And then Brother Dusk, who is older, and sort of approaching the end of his life, and still, I think, is still, like, kind of a key advisor. I think when it's sort of implied that when, you know, travel or diplomacy is needed, usually it's Brother Dusk who's in charge of that.
Yeah, he's like the elder statesman or whatever.
Right. And so it's one of the really cool things is the fact that the Brother Day, who we meet at the beginning of the show, will eventually become Brother Dusk. And, and so you get, first of all, you just get this continuity of actors. And so Lee Pace gets to be in the show for the full season and presumably in future seasons. But at the same time, he's not playing the same character. He's playing succeeding clones of the same man, which is already just very clever because you're like, oh, I see. This is how we get to have Lee Pace for covering hundreds of years. But also, I would argue that that's the sort of science fictional concept that they develop the most and explore in the most detail is, like, what does it actually feel like to be a member of this, unending chain of emperors?
Right. Yeah. I really like that too. And yeah, it's like a thing that is entirely novel to the show, like does not present any of the fiction. So that was really cool that they did. So I feel like they were very thorough with it and they did such a good job with it, despite having nothing in the source material upon which to base it. Right.
And Jordan, I mean, I think there's some stuff you wanted to talk about with Cleon that probably has to wait till spoilers, but I mean, do you agree that that was one of the coolest aspects of the show?
The genetic dynasty in general?
Yeah.
That wasn't part of the book?
No.
Wow. Yeah, no, I totally thought it was one of the coolest parts of the show. I mean, so when we started, I was like, oh, God, this is classic Apple because it's like a math, it's like a STEM promotion, right? It's like, be good at math and you'll save the world or whatever, which probably is true, but like just annoying to those of us who aren't mathematicians. Like, I like the Starbuck, like, just fight an alien and you'll make it. And then we got into, like, it started kind of explaining the whole idea of the genetic dynasty, which I thought would, of course, been a part of the book. It shocks me to hear that it's not. And I just thought it was awesome. Like, as a concept, not like I would hate to be ruled by a genetic dynasty, but as a concept in a show, it was awesome. And like the brother Dawn and Day and Dusk, like the detail that went into it was just really cool. And watching them all sit and eat and kind of like eat the same way and like, mm-hmm. but be different, but also be the same. And the idea of talking to your younger and older self and making decisions. It was really cool. And the, what's her name? Mazerda? Merezda?
Oh, Demerzel.
Demerzel. Oh, yeah. Terrible name. All three of the ones that I just said were terrible names, including the real one.
Oh, yeah. But they had those ones they had to get from the book. So that, you gotta blame Asimov for that.
Right, and Asimov is terrible at names. Like, his name is really just gobbledygook. You can tell he just threw letters onto a page.
Well, yeah. Salvor Hardin actually felt, like, the whole time I kept thinking...
That's nice to say,
Salvor Hardin is a fun... And it feels like it's connected, like, thematically. Mm-hmm. It's, like, form meeting function a little bit. Like, Salvor, like, the root of that is... Right, like save, salvation, like savior. And Hardin also, like, she's been toughened up by Terminus. So like that felt, and then I kept like looking at all the other names and I was like, do they mean anything either? It's like Hugo and like Harry, and I'm like, no, that doesn't fucking mean anything. Like, so yeah, I thought it was really cool. It's interesting when you say like there's no one you're attached to, because oddly I am attached to the Cleons. Like,
yeah,
particularly the brother Dawn, that, you know, the brother Dawn, which was an interesting twist, and it's hard for me to understand where any of that came from without the genetic dynasty being in the book.
That just didn't exist. Like, all those storylines are basically brand new.
And I mean, I when I say that there are people you don't care about, I mean specifically in the books, that the books are not books you read for interesting characters. I mean, that is one of the big differences with Game of Thrones is Harry Seldon, I think, is a very interesting character because there's something sort of almost like archetypally interesting about this guy who sets this plan in motion but lives to see none of it come to fruition. And then there's one other character in the later books called the Mule, who I think we'll meet in later seasons, who's very interesting. Everyone else, pretty much, you could sort of just plug in the names and it doesn't necessarily... It's I don't think it's, like, bad writing. It's just clear that he's not interested
it's not in the characters. Point. Yeah. They just pop up and they do what they are needed, what they're supposed to do for the plot, and then they're gone. And you don't really... You learn enough about them to, like, understand some of their decisions, but, like, nothing else, really.
Right. Whereas here, they're genuinely interested in the characters, including the Cleons. Including Gail Dornick. I also thought her... Yeah. I thought her present-day storyline... I mean, first of all, it just ended up being less important than I realized, than I was expecting, at least. But all the backstory we get about her, I thought was really... was one of my favorite parts of the show, is there's like a flashback to her childhood on this planet called Synax, where it's sort of being taken over by this religious fundamentalism, and so she has to essentially learn math in secret, which is what allows her to eventually attract the notice of Harry Seldon and get involved in the foundation. And I thought all that backstory was really compelling.
Yeah, that was really compelling. Because in the other one, it's just like, oh, look at this, like an interesting person who is good at math who happens to be from a backwater. But in this one, it's like, no, she had to actually like overcome inbuilt social rejection of that entire world, right? Which is far more interesting than
that entire world, which is also being like you know, facing rising seas due to climate change.
And her parents too, right? Like her parents were obviously, like her mom was kind of on the fence about it, but her dad clearly was very against her mathness.
But Gail Dornick is a perfect example of how the creators of the show or the writers or whoever behind it, like, looked at every element of the Asimov and was like, okay, so we have this person, we need to keep them functioning the same, but how can we make them also empathetic? And then, like, did a really good job of doing that.
Right. And then also, I mean, I think there's sort of less to say about this because I think it's just objectively a good decision, which is that in the books, not everyone, but like 90% of the characters are men, sort of implicitly white men. There are major women.
Every single character you see as a woman is a man in the books. Every single one, right?
Right. There are a few women characters in the books, but we haven't met any of them yet. So every woman in the show so far was a man in the books. Asimov.
Wait, including Demerzel?
Yeah. Demerzel is a man. Gale is a man. Salver is a man. I'm trying to think if there are other major ones. Yeah.
They're so much better as women, right?
Yeah, sure.
Especially women of color. Nailed it.
Yeah, so that is just... Of course, it's like, yes. Like, as soon as I realized they were doing that, I was like, oh, that's... Of course you would do that. Good job.
What about the Proximas on Maiden? Are they all men?
Oh, there are no Proximas.
They're not even in it.
Oh.
Yeah, this is going to be a real interesting experience when you read the books, because it is a show where they took the basic idea and setup and some of the iconography and names and things, but like the story they spun is almost completely different, especially on the Cleon side. Like all of that is sort of made up, but even on the Foundation side, it's only kind of related to what actually happens in the books.
What about the Thespian and Anacreon?
Yeah, Thespis and Anacreon are
but
both
very
real places.
Different. It's, I mean, part of it is also because
real places, real in the book.
I think part of, I mean, I think this is done well in the show, but I think the major thing that David S. Goyer did before this is he co-wrote all the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, and those are, I think, often read as 9/11 allegories, and it does sort of feel like there's a part of me that's like, oh, like whenever Goyer wants seriousness and thematic weight, he just goes back to 9/11. And so there, in the first episode, there is this giant sort of 9/11 type event. Not to say that 9/11 is the only attack of that nature, but to me, it seemed very transparent that that's kind of what he was thinking of when he wrote it in. I mean, that has, you know, these reverberations in galactic history, including for Anacreon and Thespian. Again, that's all added. That's not in the books. Which again, I think that's great. I think
so. The attack wasn't in the books either. Like, how is the fall precipitated in the books? I mean, maybe that's too big of a question for this.
It's 18 left, but I mean, it's not really a single event, right? Like the kind of the difference between the books and the TV show, a lot of it boils down to like in the books are very much like you were talking about how you like go fight it sci-fi or whatever. Like the books are the opposite of that. The books are like that is futile because it that's not how anything works, right? So it's kind of like the entire point of the books is like, oh well, like it's cerebral, and even when you're like, well, what can we do, it's kind of like there's not much you can do. You can do some things, maybe, hopefully. You can put things in the right place, but there's no, like... And there are precipitating events, sort of. There are key moments, which take the form of these crises, which they reference in the show a bunch, too, right? They're known as, like, the Selden crises or whatever. But, like, it's not a thing where you can, like, point to any one thing and go, like, well, that was what really sort of, like, started it rolling, and so you don't have that like big empire,
like you can go
event,
fight it, right? Yeah. But I do like too that it's like there's also a big theme. I think Salvor's dad brings it up where he's like, you know, you were fighting, and like who's winning, right? Like you're not winning, who's winning? So like all of the fighting doesn't really get you anywhere, which I did like. I thought that was like a point well made.
Right. I think that they try to preserve elements of the book in that, in the sense that science and rationality are part of what the Foundation is preserving and what essentially it's fighting for. And so it survives in this story to an extent. I think what has changed, and this is not disagreeing with Daryl, I think it's just a sort of another way of approaching it or stating it, is that in the books, psychohistory feels like something close to a real science where, I mean, obviously it's not. We can't actually predict the future. But mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, that makes sense. That essentially what it's doing is it's looking at the historical forces in play, and that basically the reason the Foundation triumphs in each story is because of the historical forces that are at work. And so, yes, you need a Salvar Hardin to be in charge to take advantage of the setup. But in a sense, all they're doing, like, it could have just been another person there. And as long as they were smart as well, they could have like been in that seat and won. And that actually creates a lot of like problems for the storytelling and later Foundation stories, because it's kind of like, how do you make an interesting story when
it's already been written?
Right, it's already been written. And he comes up with some interesting solutions to that in the course of the trilogy, especially the initial trilogy. But what happens in the show instead is it just feels kind of like it's filled in with like Hollywood nonsense and. Right. Math, they talk about math a lot, but math is treated as this kind of mysticism. And when the Foundation triumphs, it's not because of these trying to understand these larger historical forces at play. Because that's part of what makes the stories really fun for me. It's like reading a mystery, but the solution isn't who killed who. The solution is, economic power was the key in this situation. Or, religious fundamentalism was the key in this situation, and that sort of all gets tossed out the window. And I totally understand that there was no way you could make, it would be really, really hard to make a show where it was any other way, but I was disappointed where I had to be like,
it's like a bit of like supernatural. I mean, even the way they paint psychohistory with his little like special box, like, is like, what is that? Like, that's not something anyone could read or write in. Like, that doesn't, you know what I mean?
Right.
Just
it's kind of a shorthand for like all the like, because in the book there is like, okay, I mean, there is real math to back this up, and here it is, and you know, you have to be a mathematician of a certain caliber to even read it, right? So that little bauble is like a shorthand for that, and I think that's okay in that
no regard. It's fine. It's just when you mix it with like Salvor and Gale being like special or whatever, right? Like, then it all feels a bit like mystic.
Yeah, exactly. And which I think right now feels like, I guess also I can't help but read it through like, it feels like there's a lot of debates about sort of like, what does believe the science mean? Is that just like, are you just turning like science into like another religion, like a mantra faith, rather than actually like, you know, as instead of this complex, contested, ongoing process. But it sounds like overall we all like the show.
Oh yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed it. At first I was kind of like, oh, maybe I'm gonna like find this a little too like require too much patience for kind of like where I'm at now in terms of TV viewing habits. Like, I'm pretty impatient with TV and movies in general now, just because my attention span is ruined thanks to, I don't know, the internet, technology, whatever. But like, I ended up being really, really into it, and I loved it. I mean, and like I said, it's different enough from the book that it's a total, it's its own thing. I think it borrows a lot of the really interesting things I liked about the book. It doesn't take all of them, but it takes a lot of the stuff that I found interesting there as a jumping off point. It's almost like doing a creative writing exercise where you're like using Asimov as like a prompt, and then like just spiraling off from there, like in the best way, like not in a way that feels like fan fiction, but in a way that feels like very cool and interesting. So Yeah, I loved it. I'm eager to see more, especially now, because like once you're already there, I'm like, where do they go with other stuff? Like you mentioned the mule, but like there's going to be, and I think this isn't, we don't want to talk about spoilers, but I feel like there's already some of that there, right? And Demerzel shows up way earlier than the they do in the Asimov things, right? So they're already kind of like time shifting elements around. So yeah.
I mean, I really liked it. I thought it was really like in depth. I also during the first episode was like, I don't know about all of this. Like, it just feels a little too dense. But then it really opened up, and I'm disappointed in Asimov that the genetic dynasty wasn't a piece of it, because it feels like the crux in a way of this and the problem with the empire to begin with. But yeah, I thought it was fantastic. I'm really, really into it. Like, I dove super deep and just like was glued to the TV. The kind of thing where I looked at my phone and like clicked back 10 seconds to make sure I didn't miss anything.
I think that I will say about the genetic dynasty, I think it's just like a way to really like put a fine point on what was already present in the book, in that there's like this idea that like a empire, like a monarch approach with that kind of like lineage is stagnation, right? It like results in stagnation over the long term. And I think the genetic dynasty is just like, they make it very explicit that like that's what they're talking about, right?
Yeah, and I guess I also do think that part of the challenge is also not just that it's hard to adapt, but also that the these the first stories in the Foundation series were published in the early 40s, and so basically every single work of famous science fiction except for Frankenstein and H.G. Wells came afterwards, right? So almost everything that was cool and interesting. I mean, I think they're still like really fun stories to read, but they're not necessarily going to feel innovative anymore because all those ideas have already been used. Like if you just did a straight adaptation, like you'd just be like, wait, a new audience would say, wait, I saw Star Wars. This is Star Wars, but boring.
Yeah.
So they had to invent, like, I think there were a lot of cool new ideas that Asimov introduced. And you like, but they don't seem cool and new now. So they had to come up with some other cool new ideas. And I think they mostly succeeded. I wish, and my hope for future seasons is they do incorporate a little bit more of the cerebral socio-political stuff, because I think that's kind of core to what makes the series interesting to me. But I still think they did a pretty good job with this incredibly challenging adaptation. I also think it's just like a really gorgeous show. The Terminus stuff, I mean, is, I think intentionally is, feels a little bit like a lot of other sort of science fiction TV shows where you're just like, yep, it's a bunch of like encampments on a dirt planet. That's fine. But Trantor, which is the city planet, is really beautiful. Synax, the way they like do like just like some very like not too overwhelming or CGI for like what the sky looks like over Synax. That's like probably my favorite image in the whole show.
Yeah, I think they did a good job with the worlds and in a way that feels different than like a, I guess yeah, you're right. Like Terminus is kind of more in keeping, but it definitely feels like it doesn't feel like the Star Wars approach of like, here's a desert planet, here's a frozen planet, here's the whatever. Like, even though like conceptually it is like they're like, here's a water planet, here's a city planet. Like those are both literally things that exist in the Star Wars universe, but it feels different and I think more interesting and refreshing as executed in the Foundation series.
Should we talk a little bit about spoilers?
I don't know, maybe we should just leave it for everybody, but no, we only have a few minutes, so we might as well.
And I know there's one thing that Jordan wants to talk about at least, so if you haven't watched the entire first season of Foundation, you should stop listening now. Jordan, Cleon's limp.
Yeah, could you guys not stop laughing, because I couldn't stop laughing. Like, he is walking this salt spiral to prove that he has a soul to the religion that says a clone could never have a soul.
Yeah.
Because this religion could end up overthrowing the dynasty. And he's walking through the salt spiral for the first time in his life. He doesn't have like special bots in his blood to keep him healthy. And he doesn't have his little protective shield aura thing. And he's hurting. And his limp was like that poor actor, what are you doing? And the director too, what is happening there that you were like, this is the way we should let this happen? Like, it was the most overdone. Like, that isn't even how someone would limp if their foot was hurting. Like, it's just, I couldn't take it seriously. I was so deep in the show, and then I was like, what is this?
Maybe they cut a scene where, like, a snake bit him on the thigh or something.
I mean, it is, it was a tough day, probably, because they had to pretend that they're exhausted and dying of thirst, and without actually being necessarily exhausted or dying of thirst. And I thought the makeup people at least did a really good job. I thought,
yeah, they looked really parched and dry and kind of like weather worn, so that was good.
The one thing I wanted to talk about in spoilers was just the very end. And so, as I think we alluded to, there's sort of these multiple storylines that then mostly kind of get wrapped up at the end of the final episode. And then there is then Salvar Hardin, who's kind of the person who saved the Foundation. She realizes that all these visions she's been having were coming from this other character, Gail Dornick, who's basically been sidelined for most of the first season, and is actually her biological mother. And so she goes off looking for her, jump 135 years ahead, and they meet each other for the first time on when Gail finally arrives on her home planet, Synax. And I thought that was a really cool moment, but I thought it was really weird the way Salvar decided to leave. That it, just because, you know, her whole life has been built around protecting Terminus, and she's just suddenly like, all right, peace out. I guess I'll probably never see you guys again.
Right.
Even though I don't know why that's clear to her, because maybe it would just take a couple years, but I guess it's maybe just the uncertainty. But I guess also just, I really like Hugo. And so the fact that she was like, I was going to leave without saying goodbye to Hugo seemed pretty shitty.
Yeah. The Hugo was great.
Love story felt like real, which doesn't often happen in sci-fi shows. And I think it made sense though for her to leave, because it was like Harry's arrival as a ghost was like, I don't have any answers for you. I don't even know who the hell you are. So like,
yeah, I felt like that was what made me buy that. And also that she has, and now that we're in spoilers, we can like talk about it. Like, she has inherited this like prognostication or telepathic ability or whatever.
Sort of like intuitive sense.
Yeah, yeah. This like supernatural empathetic sense that apparently Gail Dornick has in this series too, which to what I was alluding to earlier, like this sounds a lot like kind of what the mule has, although he uses it for nefarious, I don't know, selfish purposes.
It's
anyway.
I mean, it's similar in that it's sort of this mental power that doesn't exist now. It's a different power, though. His is more about the control influence. Of emotions. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. But, like, to me, it's like maybe you have a piece and, like, that's where they're going to go. But it's something that, and Seldon kind of acknowledges this, that it's, like, it's not accounted for in the model, in the math, right? So, yeah, like that to me is what makes that believable also, is that she's like, it's kind of driven by that.
Right. She just knows it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. There's like this mystic kind of like, no, you have to do this. And also that could lead to like her knowledge, her foreknowledge of like, and I'll never see anybody else here again because I just have that certainty, right?
But, yeah. And I also liked, I mean, I knew right on, I'm sure you guys did too because you read the books obviously, but that Salvar was Gail's kid. Like, I knew it like when we met.
No, that's not part of the books.
Literally nothing you like about the show is in the books.
Maybe I shouldn't read the books then. Like, especially like hearing about the genetic dynasty, because that's definitely my favorite part. Every time we were with the Cleons, I was like, what are these jokers up to now?
Yeah, Cleon is an emperor, and then I think there are multiple Cleons maybe, or somebody else takes the name, I can't remember, but like, yeah, it's not a thing.
No clones. All right, well, I feel like we could talk about this for another hour, and maybe it'll come up at another time, but we are pretty much out of time, so rather than tackling another big topic, I'll let you guys go. Before we do that, of course, I will remind listeners that they can email us info@originalcontentpodcast.com. That's info@originalcontentpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @originalcontent. We love it when you subscribe and leave us a positive review in Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. Jordan and Daryl, I will talk to you soon.
Later.
Bye-bye.